But the man was magnificent. She pondered the thought with some pride that she could dislike him so intensely, yet still be so objective about his good looks. A sure sign of her maturity.
"Nay, it doesn't matter. You are my wife now. That's all that matters."
"Hark!"
"Hush, lass."
Adrienne stilled, absorbed in the warmth of his hands on hers. When had he taken her hands in his, and why hadn't she pulled away instinctively? And why was the slow, sensual movement of his skin against hers so intoxicating?
"Adrienne, this Calibron, for it to work correctly, it must enter the body through a primary vessel of blood."
His fingers lightly skimmed the faint red mark that still puckered the translucent skin of her throat.
This was no near miss. This was perfect aim.
"Who would want to kill me?" She swallowed tightly. How could anyone want to? No one here knew her, but what if someone wanted to kill Mad Janet and didn't know she wasn't her?
"For that, I have no answer, my heart. Yet. But until I do, you will be guarded day and night, every moment, every breath. I will not risk your life foolishly again."
"But I am not Janet Coleman," she tried again stubbornly. His ebony gaze searched her clear, gray eyes intently.
"Lass, I really don't care who you are, or have been, or need to think you'll be. I want you. In my life, in my arms, in my bed. If it makes you feel better to believe this thing about being from the future, then believe it if you must. But from this day on, you are first and foremost my wife. And I will keep you safe from anything that would hurt you. You need never fear again."
Adrienne raised her hands helplessly.
"Fine. Guard me. So can I get up now?"
"No."
"When?"
she asked plaintively. "When I say so." He smiled disarmingly and ducked to steal a kiss. His face came smack up against both her hands. It took every ounce of her willpower not to cradle it with her palms and lead him to the kiss he sought with shaking hands. He growled and gave her a long, measuring look.
"I should treat you like one of my falcons, wife."
"Let me get out of bed,"
she bartered prettily. No way was she going to ask how he treated his falcons. He growled lower in his throat, and left then. But the elite dozen stayed at her door. After he was gone, she remembered one thing he'd said most clearly. "You need never fear again." The man was just too good to be true. The days of healing were pure bliss. Lydia overrode the hawk's objections and had a chaise carried out to the gardens for Adrienne. Although she was still heavily guarded, she was able to curl up in the golden sunshine like a sleepy, smug cat, which went a long way toward healing her. The rose-drenched days of conversation with Lydia, as they came to know one another through small talk and small silences, healed more than her exhausted body. Sipping tea, she would have preferred coffee, but that would have brought the hawk and his boons into the picture, and sharing stories. Occasionally, Adrienne would shiver with the intense feeling that this was where she'd belonged all her life. Love can grow among the rocks and thorns of life, she thought in one of those small silences that was comfortable as a favored, love-worn blanket. From the desolate barrens of her own life, somehow, she had come to be here, and here life was blessed. Peaceful and perfect and simple. Adrienne healed more quickly than anyone imagined possible. Tavis pointed out that she had the resilience of youth on her side, as he flexed and studied his time-gnarled hands. Not to mention an indomitable nature, he'd added. "You mean stubborn," the hawk had corrected him. Lydia believed there might have been just a blush of love on her cheeks. "Ha!" Hawk had scoffed. "Love of the sunshine, perhaps." And Lydia had almost laughed aloud at the seething look of jealousy Hawk had turned on the bright rays as he'd gazed out the kitchen windows. Grimm offered the likelihood that she was so angry with the hawk that she hurried her healing, just to fight with him on equal footing. Now there's a man who understands women, Hawk had thought. None of them knew that, with the exception of missing her cat, Moonshadow, those days were the happiest she'd ever known. While she lazed in the peace and sunshine, Adrienne enjoyed a blissful kind of ignorance. She would have been mortified had someone told her that she'd talked about Eberhard in her drugged stupor. She would not have understood if someone had told her she'd spoken of a black queen, for her waking mind hadn't remembered the chess piece yet. She had no idea that while she and Lydia were passing sweet time, Grimm had been sent to and was now on his way back from Comyn Keep, where he'd discovered shocking information about Mad Janet. And she would have packed up a few things and run for her very life, if not her soul, had she known how obsessively determined the Hawk was to claim her as his wife, in all the aspects it entailed. But she knew none of this, and so her time spent in the gardens of Dalkeith upon the sea would be lovingly placed as a precious jewel into the treasure chest of her memory, where it would twinkle like a diamond amid the shadows. Chapter 12. It wasn't much fun snooping around the castle with a dozen hard-boiled commandos trailing along behind her, but Adrian managed. After a while, she pretended they weren't there, just as she pretended the Hawk was nothing more than an annoying gnat to be brushed away repeatedly. Dalkeith upon the sea was as lovely a castle as she'd ever imagined, when as a child she'd snuggled under a tent of blankets in bed with a pilfered flashlight, reading fairy tales long after lights out. The rooms were spacious and airy, with brightly woven tapestries hung on the thick stone walls to smother any chill drafts that might seep through the cracks, although Adrian hadn't been able to find so much as one crack in a wall. She'd peeped behind a few tapestries, just to see. Historical curiosity, she'd told herself. Not that she was hunting for imperfections in either the castle or the castle's laird. Hundreds of beautiful mullioned windows. Obviously the people who inhabited Dalkeith couldn't bear to be cooped up inside when there was so much lush landscape to be enjoyed outdoors in Scotland's mountains, vales, and seasides. Adrian sighed wistfully as she paused by a vaulted window to savor the view of the unceasing slate-silver waves crashing against the cliffs at the west end.
A woman could fall in love in a place like this. Tumble
silken tresses over dainty satin slippers to land in a mass of ribbons and romance, right at the perfect laird's perfect feet. At that very moment, as if summoned by her wayward thoughts, the Hawk walked into her line of vision in the bailey below, leading one of the largest black chargers she'd ever seen. Adrian started to turn away, but her feet would no more walk her away from the window than her eyes would avert themselves, and in spite of her best intentions to ignore him, she stood watching in helpless fascination. With a fluid leap, the kilt-clad Scottish laird tossed himself onto the back of the snorting, feisty stallion. And as he mounted, that lovely kilt went flying up, giving Adrian a sinful glimpse of powerfully muscled thighs, beautifully dusted with a bit of silky black hair. She blinked a moment, refusing to ponder what else she thought she'd seen. Surely they wore something under those kilts. Surely it was only her overactive imagination, absurdly overlaying the stallion's obvious masculinity upon the Hawk's body. Yes, that was it, decidedly. She'd noticed the stallion's prominently displayed attributes in the periphery of her vision while she'd been looking at the Hawk's legs, and managed to muddle the two together, somehow. She certainly had not seen that the Hawk was, himself, hung like a stallion. Her cheeks flushed with that thought. She turned sharply on her heel to squelch it firmly and sought the next unsurveyed room. She had decided to explore the castle that morning, in large part to keep her mind off that dratted man. It just figured that he'd have to walk by the one window she was looking out, and toss up his skirts to add fuel to the proverbial fire. She forced her mind back to the lovely architecture of Dalkeith. She was on the second floor of the castle, and had already traipsed through dozens of guest rooms, including the chamber in which she'd spent her first night. Dalkeith was enormous. There must have been 100 or more rooms, and many of them appeared as if they'd lain unused for decades. The wing she currently explored was the most recently renovated and frequently utilized. It was finished in light woods, polished to a fine gleam, and not a speck of dust could be seen. Thick woven mats covered the floors. No rushes or cold bare stones here. Bunches of fragrant herbs and dried flowers hung upside down from nearly every window ledge, scenting the corridors. A shaft of sunlight drew Adrian's attention to a closed door halfway down the corridor. Etched into the pale wood was an exquisitely detailed prancing horse, rearing elegantly, mane tossing in the wind. A single horn spiraled daintily from its equine brow. A unicorn? Her hand on the door, she paused, suddenly suffering an odd premonition that this room might be better left alone. Curiosity killed the cat. When the door swung silently inward, she froze, a hand fluttering on the jamb. Unbelievable. Simply incomprehensible. Her astonished gaze swept the room from floor to rafter, end to end, and back again. Who had done this? The room appealed to every ounce of woman in her body. Face it, Adrian, she told herself grimly. This entire castle appeals to every ounce of woman in your body, not to mention the sexy masculine laird of the keep himself. This room was made for babies, crafted with such loving hands that it was almost overwhelming. A cacophony of discordant emotions skittered through her before she shoved them away. There were cradles of honey oak, curved and sanded smooth, so not one splinter could work free and harm baby-soft skin. The east wall displayed high windows, too high for a toddler to risk harm, yet open to the golden glow of the morning sun. Wood floors were smothered with thick rugs to keep baby feet warm. Brightly painted wooden soldiers dotted the shelves, and lovingly crafted dolls reclined on tiny beds. A miniature castle, replete with turrets, dry moat, and drawbridge, was filled with tiny carved people, an honest-to-goodness medieval dollhouse. Fluffy blankets dotted the cradles and beds. It was a huge room, this nursery, a room in which a child, or a dozen, could grow from baby to young teen before seeking a more adult room elsewhere. It was a room that would fill a child's world with love and security and pleasure for hours on end. As if someone had created this room thinking like the child he or she used to be, and designed it with all the treasures that had given him or her such pleasure as a wee lad or lass. But the thing about the room that struck her so hard was that it seemed to be waiting, open and warm and inviting, saying, "Fill me with laughing babies and love." All was in readiness. The nursery was merely biding time, until the right woman would come along and breathe into it the sparkling life of children's songs and dreams and hopes. A pang of such longing flashed through her that Adrian wasn't even sure what it was, but it had everything to do with the orphan she'd been, and the cold place she'd grown up in, a place nothing at all like this lovely room, part of a lovely home in a lovely land, with people who would lavish love upon their children. Oh, to raise babies in a place like this! Babies who would know who their mother and father were, unlike Adrian. Babies who would never have to wonder why they hadn't been worth keeping. Adrian rubbed her eyes furiously and turned away. It was too much for her to deal with. And she turned right into Lydia.
Lydia!
She gasped. But of course, why should it surprise her to run smack into the wonderful mother of the wonderful man who'd probably built the wonderful nursery? Lydia steadied her by the elbows.
"I came to see if you were feeling all right, Adrian. I thought it might be too soon for you to be up in the boat."
"Who built this room?"
Adrian whispered. Lydia ducked her head, and for a brief moment Adrian had the absurd impression that Lydia was trying not to laugh.
"The hawk designed and crafted it himself,"
Lydia said, intently smoothing tiny crinkles from her gown. Adrian rolled her eyes, trying to convince her emotional barometer to stop registering vulnerability and rise to something safer, like anger.
"Why, dear Adrian, don't you like it?"
Lydia asked sweetly. Adrian turned back and swept the room with an irritated gaze. The nursery was bright and cheery and alive with the Creator's own outpouring of emotion into his creation. She glanced back at Lydia.
"When? Before or after the king's service?"
It was terribly important that she know if he had built it at 17 or 18, to please his mother perhaps, or recently, in hopes of his own children someday filling it.
"During. The king gave him a brief leave when he was 29. There was some trouble with the Highlanders in these parts, and the hawk was permitted to return to fortify Dalkeith. When the feuding was resolved, he spent a measure of time working up here. He worked like a man possessed, and in truth, I had little idea what he was doing. The hawk has always worked with wood, building and designing things. He wouldn't let any of us see it, and didn't talk much about it. After he returned to James, I came up to see what he'd been doing."
Lydia's eyes misted briefly.
"I'll tell you the truth, Adrian. It made me cry, because it told me that my son was thinking of children, and how precious they were. It filled me with wonder, too, when I saw it completed. I think it would most any woman. Men don't usually see children like this. But the hawk, he's a rare man. like his father.
You don't have to sell me on him, Adrian thought morosely.
I'm sorry, Lydia. I'm very tired. I need to go rest,
she said stiffly and turned for the door. As she entered the corridor, she could have sworn she heard Lydia laughing softly. Hawk found Grimm waiting for him in the study, gazing out at the west cliffs through the open doors. He didn't miss the tiny whiteness at Grimm's knuckles on the hand that clenched the door frame, or the rigid line of his back.
So?
Hawk asked impatiently. He would have gone to the Coman Keep to investigate his wife's past himself, but that would have meant leaving Adrian alone with the damned smithy. No chance of that. Nor could he have taken her with him, so he'd sent Grimm to uncover what had happened to Janet Coman. Grimm turned slowly, kicked out a chair, and sat heavily before the fire. Hawk sat as well, rested his feet upon the desk, and poured them both a brandy. Grimm accepted it gratefully.
Well, what did she say?
The hawk's grip tightened on his glass as he waited to hear who had done such terrible things to his wife that her mind had retreated into fantasy. The hawk understood what was wrong with her. He'd seen battle-scarred men who had experienced such horrors that they had reacted in similar fashion. Too many barbaric and bloody losses made some soldiers spin a dream to replace the reality, and in time many came to believe the dream was true, as his wife had done. But unfortunately, with his wife, he had no idea what had caused her painful retreat into such an outlandish fancy that she couldn't even bear to be called by her real name. And whatever had happened to her had left her totally unwilling to trust any man, but especially him, it seemed. The hawk braced himself to listen, to channel his rage when it came so he could wield it as a cool and efficient weapon. He would slay her dragons, and then begin her healing. Her body was growing stronger day by day, and the hawk knew Lydia's love had much to do with it. But he wanted his love to heal her deepest wounds, and the only way he could do that was to know and understand what she had suffered. Grimm swallowed, fidgeted in his chair, tilted it at the sides like a lad, then got up and moved to the hearth to shift restlessly from foot to foot.
Out with it, man!
The week Grimm had been gone had nearly driven the hawk crazy, imagining what this ever-hard man must have done. Or even worse, perhaps the Laird Coman himself was to blame for Adrian's pain. Hawk dreaded that possibility, for then it would be clan war. A terrible thing, to be sure, but to avenge his wife, he would do anything.
Who is this Everhard?
The question had been gnawing at his insides ever since the night he'd first heard the name emerge from her fevered lips. Grimm sighed.
Nobody knew. Not one person had ever heard of him.
The hawk cursed softly. So, the Coman was keeping secrets, was he?
Talk,
he commanded. Grimm sighed.
She thinks she's from the future.
I know Adrian thinks that,
Hawk said impatiently.
I sent you to discover what Lady Coman had to say.
That's who I meant,
Grimm said flatly.
The Lady Coman thinks Adrian is from the future.
What?
Hawk's dark brows winged incredulously.
What are you telling me, Grimm? Are you telling me the Lady Coman claims Adrian isn't her blood daughter?
I?
Hawk's boots hit the floor with a thump, as the latent tension charging his veins became a living heat.
Let me get this straight. Althea Coman told you that Adrienne is not her daughter?
Aye.
Hawk froze. This was not what he had expected. In all his imaginings, he had never once considered that his wife's fantasy might be shared by her mother.
Then exactly who does Lady Coman think the lass is? Who the hell have I married?
Hawk yelled.
She doesn't know.
Does she have any ideas?
Sarcasm laced the hawk's question.
Talk to me, man!
There's not much I can tell you, Hawk. And what I know, well, it's damned odd, the lot of it. It sure as hell wasn't what I expected. Ah, I heard such tales, Hawk, to test a man's faith in the natural world. If what they claim is true, hell, I don't know what a man can believe in anymore.
Lady Coman shares her daughter's delusions,
Hawk marveled.
Nay, Hawk, not unless Althea Coman and about 100 other people do, because that's how many saw her appear out of nowhere. I spoke with dozens, and they all told pretty much the same tale. The clan was sitting at banquet, when all of a sudden, alas, Adrian appeared on the laird's lap, literally out of thin air.
Some of the maids named her witch, but it was quickly hushed. It seemed the laird considered her a gift from the angels. The lady Comyn said she saw something fall out of the oddly dressed woman's hand, and fought through the panic to get it. 'Twas the Black Queen she'd given me at the wedding, which I gave to you when we returned.
I wondered why she'd sent that to me. Hawk rubbed his jaw thoughtfully.
Lady Comyn said she thought it might become important later. She said she thinks the chess piece is somehow bewitched.
If so, that would be how she traveled through...
He broke off, unable to complete the thought. He'd seen many wonders in his life, and was not a man to completely discount the possibility of magic. What good Scotsman raised to believe in the wee folk would, but still...
How she traveled through time,
Grimm finished for him. The two men stared at each other. Hawk shook his head.
Do you believe?
Do you? They looked at each other. They looked at the fire.
No!
They both scoffed at the same time, studying the fire intently.
She doesn't seem quite usual, though, does she?
Grimm finally said.
I mean, she's unnaturally bright, beautiful,
and witty. Ah, the stories she told me on the way back here from the Comyn Keep.
She's strong for a lass, and she does have odd sayings. Sometimes, I don't know if you've noticed, her brogue seems to fade in and out.
Hawk snorted. He had noticed. Her brogue had virtually disappeared when she'd lain ill from the poison, and she'd spoken in an odd accent he'd never heard before. Grimm continued, almost to himself.
A lass like that could keep a man...
He broke off and looked sharply at the hawk, cleared his throat.
Lady Comyn knows who her daughter was, Hawk. Was is the key word here. Several of the maids confirmed Lydia's story that the real Janet is dead. The gossip is that she's dead by her father's hand. He had to marry someone to you. Lady Comyn said their clan will never breathe a word of the truth.
I guess not, Hawk snorted. If any of this is true, and I'm not saying it is, the Comyn knows James would destroy us both for it.
The hawk pondered that bitter thought a long moment, then discarded it as an unnecessary concern. The Comyn would assuredly swear Adrian was Janet, as would every last man of the Douglas, if word of this ever got to the king in Edinburgh, for the existence of both their clans depended upon it. The hawk could count on at least that much fealty from the self-serving Comyn.
What did the laird himself have to say, Grimm?
Not a word. He would neither confirm that she was his daughter, nor deny it. But I spoke with the Comyn's priest, who told me the same story as Lady Comyn. By the way, he was lighting the fat white praying candles for the soul of the late Janet, he added grimly. So, if there are delusions at the Comyn Keep, they are mass and uniformly detailed, my friend.
The hawk crossed swiftly to his desk. He opened a carved wooden box and extracted the chess piece. He rolled it in his fingers, studying it carefully. When he raised his eyes again, they were blacker than midnight, deeper than a lock, and just as unfathomable.
The Lady Comyn believes it brought her here?
Grimm nodded.
Then it could take her away?
Grimm shrugged.
Lady Comyn said Adrian didn't seem to remember it. Has she ever mentioned it to you?
Hawk shook his head and looked thoughtfully, first at the Black Queen, then at his brightly burning fire. Grimm met Hawk's gaze levelly, and Hawk knew there would never be words of reproach or even a whisper of the deed, if he chose to do it.
Do you believe?
Grimm asked softly. The hawk sat before the fire for a long time after Grimm left, alternating between belief and disbelief. Although he was a creative man, he was also a logical man. Time travel simply didn't fit into his understanding of the natural world. He could believe in the banshee, who warned of pending death and destruction. He could even believe in the druids as alchemists and practitioners of strange arts. He'd been raised on childhood warnings of the Kelpie, who lived in deep lochs and lured unsuspecting and unruly children to their watery graves. But traveling through time? Besides, he told himself as he stuffed the chess piece into his sporran for later consideration, there were other more pressing problems to address, like the smithy, and his willful wife, upon whose lips the smithy's name sat far too often. The future would allow plenty of time to unravel all of Adrienne's secrets and make sense of the mass delusions at the Comyn Keep, but first, he had to truly make her his wife. Once that was accomplished, he could begin to worry about other details. Thus resolved, he stuffed away the unsettling news Grimm had brought him, much as he had stuffed away the chess piece. Plans of just how he would seduce his lovely wife replaced all worries. With a dangerous smile and purpose in his stride, the hawk went off in search of Adrienne. Chapter 13. Adrienne walked restlessly, her mind whirling. Her brief nap in the sunshine had done nothing to dispel her wayward thoughts, thoughts like just how capable, not to mention how willing, the hawk was of providing babies to fill that dratted nursery. Instinctively, she avoided the north end of the bailey, unwilling to confront the smithy and those unnerving images still fermenting in her mind from when she'd been ill. South, she strayed, beckoned by the glimmer of sun off a glass roof, and curiosity deep as a loch. These were no barbaric people, she mused, and if she didn't miss her guess, she was walking right toward a hothouse. How brilliant was the mind that had fashioned Dalkeith upon the sea! It was impenetrable on the west end due to the cliffs, which presented a sheer, unscalable drop to the fierce ocean. Spreading north, south, and east, the keep itself was sealed behind monstrous walls, all of 70 to 80 feet high. How strange that the same mind which had designed Dalkeith as a stronghold had made it so beautiful! The complicated mind of a man who provided for the necessity of war, yet savored the times of peace. Careful. Getting intrigued, are you? When she reached the hothouse, Adrienne noticed that it was attached to a circular stone tower. During her many hours of surfing the internet, she'd been drawn time and time again to things medieval. The muse? Falcons. It was there they kept and trained falcons for hunting. Drawn by the lure of animals, and missing Moonshadow with an ache in her chest, Adrienne approached the gray stone broch. What had Hawk meant about treating her like one of his falcons, she wondered. Well, she'd just find out for herself, so she'd know what to avoid in the future. Tall and completely circular, the broch had only one window, which was covered by a slatted shutter. Something about the dark, she remembered reading. Curious, she approached the heavy door and pushed it aside, closing it behind her, lest any falcons be tempted to escape. She wouldn't give the hawk any excuse to chastise her. Slowly, her eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, and she was able to make out several empty perches in the dim light. Ah, not the muse. This must be the training broch. Adrienne tried to recall the way the trainers of yore had skilled their birds for the hunt. The broch smelled of lavender and spice, the heavy musk from the attached hothouse permeating the stone walls. It was a peaceful place. Oh, how easily she could get used to never hearing the rush of traffic again, never having to look over her shoulder again, never seeing New Orleans again. An end to all the running and hiding and fear. The walls of the broch were cool and clean to the touch, nothing like the stone walls that had once held her prisoner in the gritty dirt of a New Orleans prison cell. Adrienne shuddered. She'd never forget that night. The fight had begun over, of all things, a trip to Acapulco. Adrienne hadn't wanted to go. Eberhard had insisted.
"Fine. Then come with me,"
she'd said. He was too busy. He couldn't take the time off, he'd replied.
"What good is all your money if you can't take the time to enjoy life?"
Adrienne had asked. Eberhard hadn't said a word. He'd simply fixed her with a disappointed look that made her feel like an awkward adolescent, a gauche and unwanted orphan.
"Well, why do you keep sending me on these vacations by myself?"
Adrienne asked, trying to sound mature and cool, but her question ended on a plaintive note.
"How many times must I explain this to you? I'm trying to educate you, Adrienne. If you think for a moment that it will be easy for an orphan who has never been in society to be my wife, think again. My wife must be cultured, sophisticated, European."
"Don't send me back to Paris," Adrienne had said hastily. "It rained for weeks last time."
"Don't interrupt me again, Adrienne."
His voice had been calm, too calm and carefully measured.
"Can't you come with me?
Just once? Adrienne."
Adrienne had stiffened, feeling foolish and wrong, even though she'd known she wasn't being unreasonable. Sometimes she had felt like he didn't want her around, but that didn't make sense. He was marrying her. He was preparing her to be his wife. Still, she'd had doubts. After her last trip to Rio, she'd returned to hear from her old friends at the Blind Lemon that Eberhard hadn't been seen in his offices all that much, but he had been seen in his flashy Porsche with an equally flashy brunette. A twinge of jealousy had speared her.
"Besides, I hear you don't work too hard while I'm gone," she had muttered.
The fight had begun in earnest then, escalating until Eberhard did something that so astonished and terrified Adrienne that she fled blindly into the steamy New Orleans night. He hit her, hard, and taking advantage of her stunned passivity, more than once. Crying, she flung herself into the Mercedes that Eberhard leased for her. She stomped the accelerator and the car surged forward. She drove blindly, on autopilot, mascara-tinted tears staining the cream silk suit Eberhard had chosen for her to wear that evening. When the police pulled her over, claiming she'd been driving over 100 miles an hour, she knew they were lying. They were Eberhard's friends. He'd probably called them the moment she'd left his house. He knew which route she always took home. Adrienne stood outside her car with the policeman, her face bruised and swelling, her lip bleeding, weeping and apologizing in a voice that bordered on hysteria. It didn't occur to her until much later that neither of the policemen had ever asked her what had happened to her face. They'd interrogated an obviously beaten woman without showing an ounce of concern. When they'd cuffed her, taken her to the station, and called Eberhard, she wasn't surprised at all when they replaced the receiver, gazed at her sadly, and sent her to be locked up. 3 days she'd spent in that hellish place, just so Eberhard could make his point. That was the night she'd realized how dangerous he really was. In the cool of the Brock, Adrienne hugged her arms around herself, trying desperately to exorcise the ghosts of a beautiful man named Eberhard Darrow Garrett and the foolish young woman who'd spent a lonely, sheltered life in an orphanage. Such easy prey she'd been. "Did you see little orphan Adrienne? Eberhard's little fool?" Where had she heard those sneering words? On Rupert's yacht, when they thought she'd gone below for more drinks. She shivered violently. "I'll never be a man's fool again." "Never," she vowed aloud. Adrienne shook her head to ebb the painful tide of memories. The door opened, admitting a wide swath of brilliant sunlight. Then it closed again, and blackness reigned absolute. Adrienne froze, huddled in on herself, and forced her heart to slow. She'd been here before, hiding, waiting, too terrified to draw a breath for fear of alerting the hunter to her exact location. How she'd run and hid! But there had been no sanctuary, not until the streets of obscurity she'd finally found in Seattle, and there had been an eternity of murky hell down every winding back road between New Orleans and the haven of the Pacific Northwest. Bitter memories threatened to engulf her when a husky croon broke the silence. The hawk? Singing? A lullaby? The Gaelic words tumbled husky and deep. Why hadn't she suspected he would have a voice like rich butterscotch? He purred when he talked. He could seduce the Mother Abbess of Sacred Heart when he sang. "Curious, were you? I see you came of your own accord." His brogue rolled through the brock when he finished the refrain.
"Came where?"
she asked defiantly.
"To be trained to my hand."
His voice sounded amused, and she heard the rustle of his kilt as he moved in the inky darkness. She would not dignify it with a response. A long pause, another rustle, then,
"Know you what qualities a falconer must possess, my heart?"
"What?"
she grumbled in spite of herself, moving slowly backward. She stretched out her hands like little makeshift antennae in the darkness.
"'Tis an exacting position. Few men can be quality falconers. Few possess the temperament. A falconer must be a man of infinite patience, acute hearing, and uncanny vision. Possessed of a daring spirit and a gentle yet forceful hand, he must be constantly attuned to his ladybird.
Know you why?"
"Why?" she whispered. "Because falcons are very sensitive and excitable creatures, my heart. They are known to suffer from headaches and all manner of human ailments, so sensitive are they. Their extreme sensitivity makes them the finest and most successful huntresses of all time, yet can make them the most demanding as well. And the haggard, ah, my sweet haggard, she is the purest challenge of all, and by far the most rewarding. She would not ask what a haggard was. "What is a haggard, you ask, deep in that stubborn, silent soul of yours, my heart?" He laughed richly, and it echoed off the stone walls of the suddenly balmy Brock.
"Quit my hearting me,"
she muttered as she moved back, oh, so cautiously. She had to find a wall. The Brock was round, so a wall would guarantee a door at some point. She may as well have been blind in the abysmal blackness. She heard his footfalls upon the stone floor. Dear heavens, how could he see her? But he was heading straight for her. She backed away slowly, stealthily. "I am no stranger to the darkness, lass," he warned. "I will find you. I am the finest of falconers." She said nothing, made no sound. "A haggard is a wild, mature falcon," he continued, a hint of a smile in his voice. "Usually, a falconer is reluctant to assume the challenge of training one, but sometimes, upon a truly rare moon like the harvest moon we had last eve, the falconer espies a bird of such brilliance, such magnificence, that he casts all caution aside and traps the haggard, vowing to bind her to him, vowing to make her forget all her wild, free past, whether in darkness or in light, and give herself freely only to her future with her falconer. She must not answer him. He'd follow her voice. "My sweet falcon, shall I tell you how I will tame her?" Silence. Absolute. They were circling in the darkness like wary animals. "First, I seal my lady, which is to deprive her of vision with a black silken hood." Adrian smothered an indignant gasp in her shaking hand. The folds of her gown rustled as she sidestepped quickly. "Then I blunt her talons." A pebble skittered across the floor a mere yard away. She backstepped, clutching her skirts to keep them still. "I fasten jesses and dainty bells to her ankles so that I can be aware of her every movement, for I am in the dark, too." She drew a labored breath, almost a pant, then cursed herself for slipping, knowing he would track her traitorous gasp. She knew his strategy was to keep talking until he provoked her into revealing herself. And then what? She couldn't help but wonder. Would the hawk make love to her here and now in the darkness of the Brach? A shiver coursed through her, and she wasn't certain it was fear. Not certain at all. "Then, a leash, to tether her to her perch, until I no longer need leash her, until she becomes leashed of her own free will, and the best part, the long, slow process of binding her to me. I sing to her, the same sweet song until she grows accustomed to the sound of my voice and mine alone." And his butterscotch-rich voice began that same husky croon of a lullaby, melting her will. Adrienne stepped slowly backwards. She actually felt the breeze of him passing by her mere inches away. Where was that wall? She almost screamed when he found her in the blackness, struggled a long moment against his iron grip. His breath fanned her face, and she struggled in his grasp. "Be still, sweet falcon. I will not harm you. Not ever," he whispered huskily. Adrienne felt the heat of his thighs burning through her thin silk morning gown. She was enveloped in the heady scent of musk and man. "Oh, beautiful man, why couldn't I have known you before my last illusion was shattered? Why couldn't I have met you when I still believed?" she mourned. She fought against his arms, which embraced her, cradled her.
"Let me go!"
Hawk ignored her protests, drawing her closer into the steel of his embrace.
"I'll simply have to have you sealed. Or perhaps I should bind your hands and hood your eyes with silk, and lay you across my bed, stripped bare and laid wide open to pure sensation until you become accustomed to my touch. Would that tame you, sweet falcon? Could you grow to love my touch, crave it as I crave you?"
Adrian swallowed convulsively.
"A falcon must be wooed with relentless and rough love. By taking away her light, by sealing her, she learns to understand with all her other senses, senses that don't lie. The falcon is a wise creature. She believes only what she can feel, what she can hold in her talon or her beak, touch, scent, hearing. By slowly being given back her sight and freedom, she is bound to the hand that restores these things to her. If she fails to trust in her master and doesn't grant him absolute loyalty by the end of her training, She seeks to flee at every opportunity. He paused, his lips a scant breath from hers. None of my falcons have ever flown my hand without returning, he warned.
I am not a stupid bird.
Nay, not stupid, but the finest. A falcon is the only other bird that can match a hawk for flight, accuracy, and speed, not to mention strength of heart. She'd been lost to him the moment he'd started singing, and she didn't protest further when his lips brushed hers lightly, nor did she protest in the next instant when Hawk's hands on her body turned hard, hot, and demanding, coaxing, claiming. Would you soar for me, sweet falcon? I'll take you higher than you've ever been. I'll teach you to bang heights you've only dreamed existed, he promised as he scattered kisses across her jaw, her nose, her eyelids. His hands cradled her jaw in the darkness, feeling every curve, every plain and silken hollow of her face and neck with his hands, memorizing the nuances. Feel me, lass. Feel what you do to me. He pressed his body against hers and rocked his hips, making sure she felt the swollen manhood that rose beneath his kilt and teased the inside of her thigh. And there was the wall. It had been just behind her back all the time, cool stone to her back, and the inferno of the hawk searing her through the front of her gown. She raised her hands to pummel him, but he caught and pinned them above her head against the wall. His strong fingers splayed her grip, twined with and teased her hands, palm to palm, flat against the stone. My sweet falcon, he breathed against her neck. Fight me as you will. It will come to naught. I have set my mind on you, and this is your first time to be sealed. In this blackness you will come to know my hands as they touch every silken inch of your body. I will not take from you any more than that, just that you suffer my touch. You needn't even see my face. I will be patient while you grow gentle to my hands. His hands were liquid fire, sliding her gown up and over her thighs, and, oh, she hadn't the faintest idea where to look for undergarments this morning. His hands, his strong, beautiful hands, were kneading her thighs, pushing them gently apart to slip the heat of his muscled leg between them. He purred, a rich, husky growl of masculine triumph, when he felt the betraying wetness between her thighs. Adrian flushed furiously. Despite her intentions, her hands fluttered up to rest upon his shoulders, then slid deep into his soft, thick hair. Her knees, already weak, went limp when he eased the bodice of her gown aside and dropped his head to her breasts, licking and grazing the swollen peaks with his tongue, then his teeth. She scarcely noticed when he pushed his kilt up, but she definitely noticed when his hard, hot, heavy arousal rose against her thigh. Adrian made a throaty sound, half whimper, half plea. How had he done this to her? Merely by touching her, the hawk had somehow managed to unravel every ounce of resistance she'd so painstakingly woven into the cloak of aloofness she wore. It had never been like this with Eberhard. Her mind fled her body, and she clung to the hand that had sealed her, the hand that had denied her sight. She tasted with her lips, turned her head to catch his finger with her tongue. Adrian almost screamed when he took that same finger and placed it inside the slick heat between her legs. Fly for me, sweet falcon, he urged, cupping one of her heavy breasts with his hand and licking its puckered crest. He teased her mercilessly, nipping her gently, touching her everywhere. His lips returned to claim hers with a desperation sired of a hunger too long denied, a hunger that might never relent. His kiss was long, hard, and punishing, and she reveled in his unspoken demands. A whimper escaped her when the pad of his thumb found the tiny nub of heat nestled between her folds, and Adrian's head dropped back as a burgeoning wave cast her up and up. Yielding to his fingers, his tongue and lips, she sacrificed the last vestige of her restraint. Adrian, he whispered hoarsely, you're so beautiful, so sweet. Want me, lass. Need me like I need you. She felt the heat of a place with no name she'd ever been taught, luring her deeper. Adrian struggled to say the word she knew must be said, the one word that she knew would free her. This legendary seducer of women, oh, how easy it was to understand just how legions had fallen before him. He was so good at it. He almost had her believing that it was for her and only her that he hungered. Almost a fool again. But that was why they called them rogues, Lothario's, Don Juan's. They applied the same skill and relentless determination to seduction that they applied to the art of war, to conquests of any sort. Resurrecting the tatters of her defenses, she steeled her will against his advances. The hawk was lost. Lost as he'd been since the moment he'd laid eyes upon the bewitching lass. No matter her strange fancies risen from some secret and terrible past, he would discover a way to erase all her fears. The things Grimm had told him signified nothing. With love, he could overcome any obstacle in time. His Lady Hawk she would be, for now and always. He treasured her yielding to his hands, savored like the rarest delicacy the sweet honey of her lips, trembled at the thought that she would one day feel for him as he felt for her. With her it would never be like it had been before, empty and hollow. Nay, with this lass he would mate for life. She had no eye for the beauty the other women had so adored. This lass possessed secrets of her own, horrors of her own, depth of her own. All in all, a rare lass indeed. He was sinking, sinking into her depths. The kiss deepened ferociously, and he felt her teeth graze his lower lip. It maddened him beyond control. "Oh!" she breathed as he nipped her silken neck. Emboldened by his success, he breathed the first tentative words. He needed to tell her, needed her to understand that this was no game, that he had never in his life felt this way, and never would again. She was the one he'd been waiting for all these years, the one that completed his heart.
"Ari, my heart, my love, I—"
"Oh, hush, Adam. No need for words."
She pressed her lips to his to silence him. Hawk froze, rigid as an Arctic glacier and every bit as chill. His lips went still against hers, and Adrian's heart screamed in agony. But how much worse would it scream if she became a fool again? His hands dug cruelly into her sides. They would leave bruises that would last for days. Slowly, very slowly, one by one, his fingers unclenched. She had said his name.
"The next time you say Adam's name, lass, is the time I stop asking for what I already own, and start taking. You seem to forget that you belong to me. There is no need for me to seduce you when I could simply take you to my bed. The choice is yours, Adrienne. I bid you, choose wisely."
Hawk left the broch without another word, leaving Adrienne alone in the darkness. Chapter 14. Adrienne should have worked up an appetite. She'd spent the rest of the day after the falcon incident wandering every inch of the bailey. Was this day ever going to end? She wondered. She must have walked 20 miles, so she should have burned off some of her pent-up frustration. Even her elite guard had looked a little peaked when she'd finally consented to return to the castle proper, and brave encountering the hawk. Dinner offered fluffy potato soup, thick with melting cheese and spiced with 5 peppers, a delicate white fish steamed above a fire in oiled olive leaves, garnished with buttery crab, asparagus seared to perfection, plump sausages and crisp breads, puddings and fruits, lemony tarts and blueberry pie. Adrienne couldn't eat a morsel. Dinner was awful. If she glanced up one more time and caught the look of death the hawk had fixed on her, she would have to stuff a fist in her mouth to keep from screaming. Adrienne sighed deeply as she spooned at the soup everyone else seemed to be relishing. She pushed it, poked at it, smashed the fluffy stuff. She was busily rearranging her asparagus into neat little rows when the hawk finally spoke.
"If you're going to play with your food, Adrienne, you might give it to someone who's truly hungry."
"Like you, my lord."
Adrienne smiled sweetly at the hawk's plate, which was also laden with untouched food. His mouth tightened in a grim line.
"Is the food not to your liking, Adrienne dear?"
Lydia asked.
"It's wonderful. I guess I still don't have my appetite back,"
she started. Lydia sprang to her feet.
"Perhaps you should still be resting, Adrienne,"
she exclaimed, shooting an accusing look at her son. The hawk rolled his eyes, refusing to get involved.
"Oh, no, Lydia,"
Adrienne protested quickly.
"I am totally recovered."
No way she was going back to the Green Lady's room and playing invalid. Too many strange memories there. Tonight she'd planned to find a new room to sleep in. There certainly wasn't a shortage in this massive castle.
she was rather looking forward to exploring the place further and selecting a room of her own.
"Really? I'm fine. I just ate too much at lunch."
"You didn't eat lunch," Hawk said flatly.
"Oh, and who are you to know?"
she shot back.
"Maybe I ate in the kitchen."
"No, you didn't," Tavis added helpfully. "I was in the kitchen all day, I'll say. Plum forgot to eat is what you did, my lady. A time or two I've done the same thing myself, I'll say, and the hungrier I get, the less I feel like eating. So you'd better be eating, my lady. You'll be needing your strength back, and I'll say that again."
An emphatic nod of his cheerful head punctuated his decree. Adrian stared at her plate, a mutinous flush coloring her cheeks. Lydia glared at Tavis as she came to stand protectively beside Adrian's chair.
"I find I'm not all that hungry myself," Lydia said. "We'll see you when I go for a walk in the gardens." "With the brute force trailing behind," Adrian muttered, glancing at Hawk beneath lowered lashes. "While my son gets some beans from the buttery and brews us a fine cup of coffee for our return,"
Lydia continued, dangling the bribe as if she hadn't been interrupted. Adrian sprang to her feet, anything to escape his eyes, and coffee to boot. Betrayal shone in the Hawk's eyes now. Lydia took Adrian by the hand and started to lead her to the gardens.
"I'll brew the coffee, mother," Hawk said to their backs, "but see to it that Mary has Adrian's things moved to the peacock room."
Lydia stopped. The hand holding Adrian's tightened almost imperceptibly.
"Are you quite certain, Hawk?"
she asked stiffly.
"You heard her. She is completely recovered. She is my wife. Where best to guard her?"
"Very well. Where's the peacock room?"
Adrian spun on her heel to face him.
"On the third floor."
"Will I have it to myself?"
"As much of it as I don't use. 'Tis the laird's chambers."
"I am not sleeping with you."
"I don't recall asking you to."
"You oversized, arrogant, conceited jackass!" "Really, Adrian, my son is none of those things,"
Lydia chastened.
"No reflection on you, Lydia. I really like you,"
Adrian said politely. Politeness decamped abruptly as she glared at the Hawk.
"But I'm not sharing your bed."
Not quite the topic to be banding about over the dinner table, I'll say,"
Tavis offered, scratching his head, a flush stealing over his cheeks. Hawk laughed, and the dark rumble vibrated through her body, leaving her nipples erect and her heart hammering.
"Wife, you will share my room this eve if I must have you tied and carried there. Either you can suffer that humiliation, or you can come willingly upon your own 2 feet. I'm not much concerned with how you get there. Just get there."
Mutiny rose up in her breast, threatening to steal her very senses. Dimly she heard the door behind her open and shut, and caught the scent of a cloying perfume that turned her stomach. Whatever the scent was, it reminded her of the orphanage, of attics and mothballs and days the nuns had made her scrub the floors and dust the heavy dark furniture.
"Lover!"
came the cry of feminine delight from behind her. Lydia's hand tightened painfully on hers.
"Olivia Dumont,"
she muttered almost beneath her breath.
"Dear heavens, I doubt I'll see this day through sane." "Olivia!"
Adrian echoed, her eyes flying to the Hawk's.
"Olivia,"
the Hawk thought gloomily. This day was rapidly running the gamut from bad to worse. He refused to meet Adrian's questioning gaze. How dare she call him Adam in the midst of their lovemaking and then ask questions about another woman? She had no right, not after she'd said his name. Fury consumed him every time he thought about it. Adam. Images of his hands ripping apart the smithy, flesh from bone, comforted him for a moment. Then desolation overwhelmed him. Now he had 2 problems. How was he going to make Adrian want him? And what was he going to do with Olivia? Fix Olivia up with the smithy? That brought a grin to his face, the first in a while. And naturally, Adrian misunderstood it, thinking his smile was meant for Olivia, as did Olivia. As, it appeared, did his mother from the scowl on her face. Grim cursed softly beneath his breath. Tavis shook his head, muttered a heated oath, and stalked from the heavily laden dinner table.
Olivia,
Hawk inclined his head.
What brings you to Dalkeith?
Why, Hawk,
Olivia purred.
Need you ask? I've missed you at court. You've been away from my side for far too long. I surmised I'd simply have to come collect you myself if I wanted you. So?
She finished with a flutter of lashes and a blatant come-hither look.
Here I am.
Hawk realized belatedly what a stupid question he'd asked, as Adrian fixed Olivia with a chilling gaze. Hawk knew from experience that Olivia could answer any question, no matter how innocent, with a loaded innuendo. But he'd shut the unpleasant memory of her antics from his mind the moment he'd returned to Dalkeith. It occurred to him that he would do well to resurrect those memories quickly. It would be unwise to forget Olivia's penchant for troublemaking. The asp was in his nest now. Olivia's breath caught audibly as she stared at Adrian.
"Greetings, Olivia. Have you come to speak with my husband?"
Momentarily free of Adrian's wrathful gaze, the hawk preened. "Husband," she'd said, and she'd said it possessively. Perhaps there was hope after all.
"We've spoken quite the common language in the past," Olivia drawled. "A sort of wordless communication, if you catch my drift. Just the kind of talk the hawk likes the best."
"Put her in the peacock room, then,"
Adrian spat over her shoulder as she tugged Lydia out the door and slammed it behind her. Chapter 15
"The king may have released you from his service, but I would never dream of releasing you from mine. You've serviced me so well in the past, I swear I'm quite spoiled."
Olivia wriggled closer on the low stone bench in the courtyard, resting the curve of her ripe hip against the hawk's muscular thigh. Lydia had returned alone to the house a scant quarter hour after she and Adrian had left, shooting a smug smile at her son, where he reclined at the great table with the infernal Olivia. Coffee forgotten, the hawk had quickly steered Olivia to the gardens to see what his wife might be up to. When his mother looked at him like that, well, the woman had a mind like a well-oiled catapult, deadly in the attack. So he had strolled Olivia through the vast gardens at a breathless pace, his eyes peeled for the guards trailing his wife. Nothing. Time and time again his eyes had been drawn northward, to the flickering rim of firelight at the edge of the rowans.
"May I assume we'll entertain each other tonight, as we used to, Hawk?"
Olivia's warm breath fanned his cheek. Hawk sighed inaudibly. "Olivia, I'm a married man now." Olivia's laugh tinkled just a bit too brightly, reminding Hawk that she was a woman who delighted in stealing another woman's man. The more difficult the man was to obtain, the happier Olivia was. Hawk was well acquainted with her peculiar game. She enjoyed hurting other women, crushing their dreams, breaking their hearts. Hawk suspected it was a revenge of sorts, that once a woman had taken her man, and she'd never gotten over it, had become a bitter, destructive woman instead. Once he'd finally understood, he'd felt almost sorry for her. Almost.
"She's Mad Janet, Hawk,"
Olivia said dryly. "Her name is—" He broke off abruptly. He mustn't give Olivia any ammunition. He took a careful breath and rephrased. "Her middle name is Adrienne. 'Tis the one she prefers," he added coolly. "You may call her Lady Douglas." Olivia's brow rose derisively.
"I shan't call her Lady anything. The whole country knows she's mad as a rabbit hound. I hadn't heard, however, that she was bearable to the eye."
Hawk snorted. "Bearable? My wife is exquisite by any standards." Olivia laughed shakily. Then her voice firmed sarcastically.
"Well, and la-di-da, could it be that the legendary hawk thinks he is in love? The roué of endless women thinks he might stop with this one? Oh, do give it up, mon chéri. It's nauseating. I know what kind of man you are. There's no point in affecting elevated sensibilities we both know you don't possess."
Hawk's voice was icy when he spoke. "Contrary to your expectations, I am not the man I was at James's court. You don't know anything about me, other than the illusions you've chosen to believe in." He paused a heavy moment to lend emphasis to his next words. "Olivia, there is no king here to order me to accommodate you, and I'm never going back to James's court. It's over. It's all over." The moment the words were said, Hawk's heart soared. He was free.
"That's all it was? You accommodated me?"
Olivia demanded.
You knew that? Hawks snorted derisively. I turned you away a dozen times before you went to James. Did you convince yourself that I'd had a change of heart? You know exactly what happened. It was you who petitioned the king to make me...
Hawk broke off abruptly, catching the glint of a silvery blonde mane in the moonlight a few yards from where they sat. Adrian approached, her arm tucked in the crook of Adam's elbow, a splendid crimson cape thrown over her shoulders, the silk billowing sensually in the gentle evening breeze.
Olivia.
Adrian inclined her head. Olivia snorted lightly and possessively grasped the hawk's muscled arm.
Join us,
the hawk said quickly, ignoring the sudden pinch of Olivia's nails. The thought of Adrian walking off into the darkness with Adam did dangerous things to his head. Hawk frowned as he realized that it was likely as dangerous for Adrian to be exposed to anything Olivia might say or do. He certainly didn't want the conversation to continue where it had broken off, not in front of Adrian, without an explanation from him. He knew he had to gain control, but he had no experience with this type of situation. He'd never had an ex-mistress try to provoke trouble with his wife, because he'd never had a wife before, and he'd certainly never been entangled in an encounter so rife with hazardous potential. His concern that Olivia might say or do something to hurt Adrian unbalanced his customary logic. Fortunately, and unfortunately, depending on how he viewed it, Adrian declined his offer.